Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettinger, your Monday host, with my theme of food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Coming up in this half hour, we're going to be talking with Shelburne resident Barbarina Heyerdahl about her trip to Cuba in February to see how Cuba made it through its peak oil experience in the 1990s. First, I want to do something I forgot to do in the introduction to the show. I often talk about my kind of unconventional ways of getting to WDEV and back. In the winter, I've fallen into a nice routine where I bicycle from East Montpelier into Montpelier, where Jack Donovan picks me up on the way to the studio, and I hang out here and work in the morning and work for about an hour and a half after the show is over, and then take the bus back to Montpelier and bicycle home. But it's such a beautiful day today that I got out my recumbent bicycle, my laid-back, lean-back bicycle, and had some morning meetings in Montpelier, and then got on that and bicycled a long route to get here. Lovely way to get to the studio, and I got on Ken Squire's case for not having employer-sponsored showers here for me to get all primped up for the radio show. But fortunately, you know, it's not like TV. My hair doesn't have to be perfect, and it's a beautiful day for, if you call that weather line that Artie just gave the number for, it's a beautiful day for biking back, you'll find. But I'm going to stick around, take the GMTA, the Green Mountain Transit Authority bus back to Montpelier. For $2, it's a bus. It's a bargain. It gives me another hour or so to work here. Barbarina, I'm going to talk about Cuba. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Carl. Well, I guess I'll just start by saying my motivation to go to Cuba was a movie that was put out by an organization called The Power of Community. Or Community Solutions, rather. And the movie is called The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil.
It's one of my favorite movies about peak oil.
It is mine as well, especially because it offers a positive picture and not just the scary possibilities of the future. And one of the things I was particularly impressed by was how Cuba completely transformed its agricultural economy in very short order. I think when the Soviet Union fell apart, Cuba lost its major trading partner, and over the course of 3 months lost 80% of its imports of pesticides and fertilizers. They also lost about 60% of their oil imports. They
60% lost of their oil imports over 3 months.
Over 3 months, and their GDP dropped by 65%.
That's more than a recession.
Yes.
That's like a great, great depression.
A great, great depression. In 1933, I think the U.S. economy had lost 33% over several years.
From 1929, and right. Cuba lost 65% over a few months.
Over a few months.
Wow.
And so they were faced with having to completely revamp their agricultural system or realistically face mass starvation.
So what'd they do?
Well, it was fortunate that there had been several agricultural specialists in the Ministry of Agriculture who were particularly interested in organic agriculture. And even though they had done quite a scathing critique of Cuba's chemically based fertilizer, pesticide, fossil fuel based agricultural system, the Castro regime had not been particularly interested. But once they lost all of their agricultural inputs, pretty much, they really did have a plan in the wings that they could implement quite quickly. And so
there's enough multiplicity of voices in this dictatorship that people could be working on things that didn't meet with the approval of the central government right away.
Yes, I think the scientists, the agricultural scientists who've been working on this hadn't been getting much encouragement, but they had been going along doing it anyway. And so they transformed their agricultural system over about 4 or 5 years from being primarily commodity-based for export. So their main exports were sugar and rum.
Cigars?
Cigars, of course, which are still a big crop. And some coffee. To completely transforming it to small-scale, diversified, organic agriculture, which was primarily geared towards feeding their own people. They were still exporting some sugar and certainly those Cuban cigars are very popular, but it was an enormous shift to go from pretty much importing the bulk of their food to producing the bulk of it.
So this is what we learned in this film by Community Solutions, The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And you went down to investigate for yourself. What really happened and what does it look like now? How did you get down there?
I was able to go legally with an organization called Global Exchange, which had a license for U.S. citizens to travel to Cuba, because it's currently illegal for U.S. citizens to go to Cuba without a license.
This is under the rubric of cultural exchange, is that right?
Research.
Research.
So we were
okay.
going for research specifically to study how Cuba had transformed its agricultural system to an organic one.
Mm-hmm.
And we also looked a little bit at renewable energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so how many people were in your group?
It was small. There were seven of us.
Mm-hmm.
There were two college students from Canada, both interested in sustainable agriculture. And there was an anthropologist and professor from the University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a woman interested in resource issues, specifically fisheries.
Mm.
Cubans haven't done much with their fisheries lately. Mm. And then there was myself and another friend who's interested in sustainability issues.
Mm-hmm. And did you go through Canada or through Mexico?
How did we went through there? Mexico.
Okay.
So we took the train to New York City and then flew to Cancun and then from Cancun to Havana.
No direct flights from the U.S. to Cuba because of the embargo?
No, although that looks like it's about to change since
really?
Obama has changed the travel restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like there will be flights out of Miami again, but I think they will only be for Cuban Americans.
Right, right. Very good. So what did you find there?
Well, I think the thing I was most impressed by was the pride that individuals had in what they had been able to accomplish under extraordinarily trying situation.
Mm-hmm.
There were some elders in particular. We visited one couple who lived in a very modest home in quite a poor neighborhood in Havana. I'm forgetting their names. Victor and Pepe.
Okay.
And their mission was to help with Cuba's food sovereignty by teaching people food preservation.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only has Cuba suffered from losing their imports from the Soviet Union, they've also been nailed by repeated very severe hurricanes.
Mm.
So this elderly couple were particularly concerned in helping people to know how to solar dry foods,
mm.
how to preserve foods with vinegar, how to can, and so that everyone would be thinking about not only growing for the moment, but having several months' food supply on hand, because
mm-hmm.
they never know when a hurricane's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And they have brochures and pamphlets that they've produced. They have a television show that's on several nights a week teaching people how to do solar drying and canning, and they have lots of school groups that come through.
Mm. Now, this is almost 20 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the reduction in their subsidies to elimination of their subsidies to the Cuban economy. Do you find that ordinary people still need to be learning these skills, or were they directed mostly at young people who were just starting households of their own?
I think one of the things that the Cuban population had to assimilate very quickly was a huge change in their diet.
Mm.
And that's a cultural change.
Mm.
And the Cuban diet before 1989 was mostly meat and refined food based, not very many vegetables. Mm. And the diet is now largely vegetarian, and there's a huge proportion of vegetables in their diet. And that has been hard for some people to assimilate. So my sense was that these ongoing educational efforts are to help make these quote-unquote new foods continue to be acceptable.
Mm.
And just learning new ways to prepare them.
We're talking with Barbarina Heyerdahl, a Shelburne resident who visited Cuba in February to see for yourself how successfully they've adapted to energy constraints there. If you'd like to talk to her about that, the number here is 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So in the movie, The Power of Community, we see lots of urban agriculture in Havana. People are raising food for themselves in Havana, and they supply a huge proportion, I forget what it is, but a huge proportion of their own fresh vegetables. Did you see evidence of that?
We definitely did. If you're just walking down the sidewalk of the main boulevards, it's not very obvious because the architecture in Cuba is much more designed for inner courtyards behind the front facade of the homes. But we were able to visit urban farms, and one of the things that happened quite quickly after 1989 was that abandoned lots were basically given to the local communities to convert into farms. So one farm we visited was about the quarter of a size of a New York City block, and it employed 16 people, very high-paying jobs by Cuban standards. And they had a farm stand at that farm that was open from 9 in the morning until 6 in the evening, Monday through Saturday. And certainly while we were there, there was a steady line of customers, but what the manager reported was that they are pretty much constantly selling very high quality food.
And the customers were actually coming away with things.
Oh, with big baskets of things.
Okay, because I was in the Soviet Union before it collapsed, and I could see steady lines was the story of people's life in the Soviet Union. But they often didn't come away with very much, maybe a long line for a loaf of bread, something like that.
Well, I actually found it was quite different going to a supermarket as opposed to going to a farm stand or a farmer's market, where the commerce seemed to be very lively at the farm stands and the farmer's markets, whereas the grocery stores were quite empty.
I don't know. Empty of goods or empty of people or both?
A little bit of both. Mm. They just didn't seem to have the vibrant commerce going on that I saw at the farm stand or at the farmer's markets.
And similar selection? Or?
No, totally different. Vegetables pretty much were not sold in the grocery store as far as I could tell. It was
prepared
more
goods?
Prepared goods, canned foods.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm. So what else was noteworthy to you about your visit to Cuba and food production in particular?
Well, I think one of the big questions my group had, and we would discuss quite heatedly at all of our meals, was it necessary to have something like an artificial peak oil imposed and to have a dictatorship and a communist system so quickly change one's food production system?
Mm.
So two questions that we would debate were, if the embargo that the U.S. currently has imposed against Cuba were lifted and they had all the oil and pesticides and fertilizers and tractor parts that they wanted, would they go back to a more conventional chemical agricultural system?
Mm-hmm.
The second question was...
Did you ask Cubans that?
There was one academic, he was a professor at one of the agricultural colleges, who was probably the most candid official representative of the government that we talked to. And he said, blessings on you Americans for your embargo, because without it, we would have never done this. I will tell you, that sort of sentiment was not what we heard in general. It's amazing the impact that our country has on this small island nation every day for 50 years, the hardships that they've experienced. But this one academic had the perspective that it would take something as massive as the embargo and the collapse of the Soviet Union for a nation to turn so quickly to a more sustainable, sane approach to agriculture.
Did he say blessings on Fidel Castro for imposing a communist dictatorship on us and for not letting us have free elections since 1959?
He did not say that. I don't know that he would keep his job if he said something like that. Well, the second question that we debated quite actively as a group were there lessons that America could learn from Cuba without adopting socialism or communism or having a dictatorship or throwing our Bill of Rights out the window?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are. Whether or not we would adopt them is another question. But one thing that particularly impressed me, and I've been in agriculture on and off my whole life, and I'm particularly interested in biodiversity and seeds, was that every municipality in Cuba has a seed grow-out farm for open-pollinated varieties of vegetables and food crops.
Sort of a seed bank.
Well, they're just, every year they're growing out seeds that are then available to everyone in the municipality. The idea that this is a really vital resource that everyone in a community should have access to.
So if that were true in Vermont, and we have hundreds of municipalities in Vermont, how many municipalities are there in Cuba? I don't know how they're...
113.
113. So over 100 seed banks or seed grow-out stations.
Seed grow-out stations. And then they also have numerous seed banks where they're keeping all of their seed varieties in atmospherically controlled conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then every few years, as the seeds would be losing their fertility, they will grow them out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something we could do in this country right now. We only have two seed banks. I think most people happily buy seeds, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of true food sovereignty, having a control of your seed supply is also an important thing.
Mm. At Transition Town Montpelier, you can find out about the seed-saving group that formed at our last open space at the beginning of this month. If you go to www.transitionvermont, all spelled out, all one word, transitionvermont.ning.com, or just type Transition Vermont into a search engine somewhere. Then you can find the website and find the seed-saving group. They've had couple of workshops since that meeting early in April, but it's a long way from having any municipality here have a seed bank. Is there a seed grow-out operation in Vermont in the public sector? There's High Mowing Organic Seeds in Hardwick that does it commercially. Who does it in the public sector in Vermont?
I don't know.
That'd be sort of thing. We have town forests. We have a tradition of town forests.
Right.
I wonder if you could work with that and extend it to make town seed grow-out operations.
Yes.
They take considerably more management than forests do.
They do, and a great deal of skill. Vandana Shiva, who's a agricultural and environmentalist advocate from India, describes seeds and biodiversity as part of the commons.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very different attitude in America, where we've made seeds intellectual property rights.
Some seeds.
Some seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And a question was asked by one of my group of this researcher at the institute, where he was telling us about the seed grow-out farms. You know, how do you protect intellectual property rights? And he couldn't really understand the concept. Having access to seeds is just perceived as a local right. It's a it's part of the commons.
Mm. Yeah, and here, you know, that's true for open pollinated varieties in general, as far as I understand it. But there are a lot of hybrids out there that people use that are the property of Monsanto and other large corporations. So, local seed grow-out operations, that's one thing that you think we can do here.
Yes.
And we ought to do.
I think so. I think their urban agriculture is so inspiring. Not only is it the farms that are taking up to a quarter block, but many rooftops have very diversified, small-scale, really agricultural operations going on. They would take watering troughs and use them as raised beds and have lots of different greens and tomatoes and peppers and culinary and medicinal herbs growing. But they also have chicken coops up
right
on rooftops.
Right on the rooftops.
They have rabbit hutches, lots of bees. And then also there are what they call patio gardens, where you'll have a very small house, maybe on a lot that's 1,000 square meters, and every square inch is planted with food crops, with fruit trees, with medicinal plants. And another really inspiring couple we met, they were in their 70s, and they run a permaculture patio garden. They bring school children in 3 times a week where they give them lessons on permaculture. And in addition to providing all of their own fruits and vegetables, they sell at a local farmer's market. And they were very proud because they were awarded the highest level of excellence by Raul Castro. And in order to do that, they also were writing research papers that they were presenting at their local agricultural fair every year. And it was just great to see an older couple who were so impassioned about food sovereignty and not only growing their own food, but really sharing the abundance that they had with their neighbors and educating children.
Now, one thing I've been thinking about lately is the ability to make the transition to much greater food, local food production quickly versus actually having done that. You mentioned that there were people working within the research establishment who had thought about how to do local food production. And you know, once the conditions for having an export-oriented economy changed so quickly with the collapse of the Soviet Union, then Cuba moved along their plans. And one statistic we haven't mentioned yet, but the movie The Power of Community talks about the average Cuban losing 20 pounds in the first 3 years or so after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's some literal belt tightening that was going on there. And I'm looking at a bill that's in the House right now for a farm-to-table strategy, basically, for Vermont to set up a local food production strategy. They want to see 20% of our food that we eat here locally produced by the year 2020. Currently, it's around 5%.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's great to be moving in that direction. And I'm wondering how fast, if that's fast enough. But I'm thinking maybe if we set up the apparatus for being ready to move quickly in that direction if we need to, then we don't need to get there much faster than circumstances compel us. So what are your thoughts on that, Barbarina?
Oh, I agree. And I think that there are probably plenty of people involved with agriculture who have such plans that they've been drafting either in their head or have committed to paper. One person who comes to mind is Russell Libby. He's the executive director of the Maine Organic Farmer and Gardeners Association, the equivalent of NOFA here in Vermont. He's very aware of peak oil, very much strategic. He has the goal of getting 20% of all Maine families connected with a CSA. So I think encouraging people to start developing those plans is a great idea. At least having them waiting in the wings could help implement them depending on what time frame is actually asked of us.
Do you know people who have plans like that in Vermont or what they look like in Maine?
No. Okay. But Russell's a great person to talk to.
Mm. In the meantime, I think just getting more people cycling through farms, working as apprentices on farms and doing their backyard gardens, and just getting a feel for what it takes to nurture something from a seed to a crop that you can eat and prepared food. It's got to be a step in the right direction.
Absolutely. And one nice thing that I do know that happens in Maine is called a journeyship program or journeyman program. So in addition to being an apprentice, a young aspiring farmer is then basically leased a farm, and they have the equivalent of a PhD panel from MOFCA, who is there to help them develop their business plan, help them with marketing, is there for technical advice, and just sort of guide them through the next 3 years of them developing as a farmer.
Wow.
Because that's one of the tricky things, is providing young aspiring farmers with adequate education.
It takes a village to raise a new farmer, to train a new farmer.
It does.
That's great. How many people have gone through that, do you know?
I don't know. I think several dozen.
Hmm.
But that was something that was impressive about Cuba, is agricultural education permeates from kindergarten through seniors. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely something we could do in the United States. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite quotes by Barbara Kingsolver in Animal Vegetable Miracle is, what committee decided that every 11th grader needed to know trigonometry, but that none needed to grow needed to know how to grow food?
Mm. Good point. Well, we've got about a minute left, and I know you're involved in the transition movement as well, starting up a transition town in Shelburne. Can you talk about the connection between what you saw in Cuba and transition Vermont?
Well, I think it was just inspiring to see the difference that individuals can make in terms of, you know, just two people spreading the word about how to grow food, how to preserve food, just the awareness that having some say over one's food supply is really important, and collaborating. There was such a sense of farmers collaborating with each other. Mm. Tremendous support from home gardeners through farmers who are managing large tracts. I guess what inspires me about transition is the idea that a group of people can accomplish so much in terms of transforming a system, whether it's our food supply or our home energy.
Well, let us know when you get a slideshow. Or do you have a slideshow ready to show now?
Not quite yet, but
okay.
I hope to soon.
Okay, let us know when you're showing it, and we'll advertise it on the show.
Well, thank you very much.
We've been talking with Shelburne resident Barbarina Heyerdahl, fresh back from Cuba a couple months ago. Thanks, Barbarina.
Thank you.
So electricity and liquid fuel are a couple of the energy supplies that we're wrestling with, how to preserve our access to and also the services that they supply us with. And I think Cuba gives us some good examples of how we can live with a lot less liquid fuel than we have right now and still live a decent life, maybe 20 pounds lighter, but a decent life. I'm Carl Etnayer. That's it for today's Equal Time. Travin's in tomorrow. Anthony Polina will be in on Wednesday and Thursday. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the show that Travin and I host. Artie Levine produced the show. Stay tuned for music with Jack Donovan. Thanks for tuning in.